Hello, this is Matt Woodbury. I'll be bringing you the first half of the Pantograph News today from the edition dated Friday, January 12th. First story up today is entitled Building Obsolete Amid Reforms. State Farm employees are leaving the insurer's downtown building by the end of the month as the company redefines itself as a modern workplace, a move that includes condensing its information technology departments, realigning management, offering buyouts, and redesigning space at its headquarters and corporate South campuses. State Farm informed Twin City leaders about the decision during phone calls Thursday afternoon. The company plans to continue to call Bloomington home with its 15,000 local employees, State Farm executive Mary Schmidt told the Pantograph earlier in the day. We don't have plans for our employees to return to that downtown facility in the foreseeable future, said Schmidt, the company's executive vice president and chief administrative officer. We have not made any decision about the future of this building, but once the maintenance work is complete, we will explore all options for the future. The 89-year-old building has been a downtown beacon for decades and was the original headquarters of the Bloomington-based insurer. At its peak, the downtown building housed up to 900 employees, including founder G.J. Mercer and some of the workers who used roller skates to quicken their deliveries. The remaining 150 employees will be moved to other State Farm offices in Bloomington by the end of the month, Schmidt said. To offer customers a competitive price, we have to have operation efficiencies, said Schmidt. While it's never easy to close a location, we gave people, in some cases, 4 years' notice because we wanted to make sure everyone in these facilities has ample time to make personal and professional decisions. Despite the lost downtown, local officials expressed optimism about the company's long-term commitment to the community. It's a loss for our downtown and a loss for Bloomington Normal. It's an iconic building, and it represents a lot of State Farm history in this community, said Bloomington Alderman Karen Schmidt, whose Ward 6 includes the building. I know they have made some very difficult decisions as they strategize about their future, and I also know they have a legacy of being good neighbors in Bloomington Normal. So when it gets to the point they're deciding about the future of the building, I have every confidence they'll be working with the city and the downtown community to make some wise decisions. Karen and Mary Schmidt are not related. We work with State Farm on a regular basis, and they are committed to this community and to maintaining a strong workforce here with 15,000 employees. They've continued to prove that, said Kyle Hamm, CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. Any realignment with office space is just part of a larger plan for them to be efficient and make things work for them. In May, State Farm announced plans to close 11 facilities across the U.S. over the next 4 years, displacing 4,200 employees. The insurer planned to move the work to the Bloomington headquarters and its regional hubs. As part of the company-wide restructuring, employees may be moved to different locations or different roles, or they may choose to leave State Farm, Mary Schmidt said. State Farm is in the midst of renovating its corporate headquarters along Veterans Parkway to accommodate large departments and teams into smaller gathering areas to promote group dynamics and collaborations, Mary Schmidt said. As part of the changes, the company's three IT departments have been combined into one. Mary Schmidt did not provide the number of job losses that resulted from the consolidation. The majority of our IT is and will continue to be housed at Corporate South, and we're also expanding some operations in the hubs for the technology areas, she said. The IT changes will allow more and faster services, she said. The restructuring has been shared with employees over the past several months. If we don't get this technology piece right, we will not be as competitive as we could be, she said. So it's critical that we make sure this transformation is successful. While the downtown building, 112 East Washington Street, is not for sale at this time, its size and layout do not align with the workplace model already in place at regional hubs in Atlanta, Dallas, and Phoenix. The downtown building is an important part of our legacy, but we have decisions to make regarding the future of that building, she said. The downtown building is not conducive for that open, collaborative environment that our employees need in terms of their environment. The space is very chopped up and not conducive to housing large groups of employees. Since 2015, The company has spent $1.6 million on improvements to the downtown building, including asbestos abatement and new fire sprinklers and alarms. Schmidt believes the work should be completed in 3 months. The building housed as many as 300 employees in the last couple of years, she said. We've got 15,000 employees here in Bloomington, so the number of employees that could ever house in that facility is not significant compared to our total employee presence here in Bloomington, Barry Schmidt said. For a little extra background information on the State Farm building, here are some interesting background facts. It was the previous corporate headquarters of the insurance company, founded in 1922, and served that role until 1974. It's also been called the State Farm Fire Building. The original section of the Art Deco building, 8 floors on the south side, was constructed in 1929. In 1934, 4 additional floors and a penthouse were added. The building expanded subsequently in 1939 and 1949. The original south portion of the building includes the red illuminated State Farm Insurance lettering. The letters stand 5.5 feet tall and have been electrically lighted since 1935. The building was designed by Archie Schaefer and Philip Hooten, who previously worked with noted Twin City architect Arthur Pillsbury. Company founder George G.J. Mercier moved into an office on the 8th floor in 1940. The company has kept it intact since. The office faced east toward Mercier's beloved Myrna Farm. In its day, the building was considered one of downtown's skyscrapers. For a short time in the 1940s, the building had roller skaters who delivered mail. The building didn't have air conditioning until the 1950s. Mercier, however, had fresh air pumped from the basement into his office. The building is listed as a contributing property for the Bloomington Central Business District's listing in the National Register of Historic Places. In 1999, 900 people worked at the downtown location. Today, that number is about 150. Continuing on the same theme, we have another story about the State Farm building. This one entitled, Officials, Site Has Role as Downtown Reinvents Itself. Officials remain optimistic about the future of downtown Bloomington despite State Farm's decision to pull employees out of its historic 112 East Washington Street building. We've seen downtown reinvent itself many times, said Alderman Karen Schmidt, whose Ward 6 includes the building. And what I appreciate about downtown and the people who have a vision and have invested there is their appreciation for its history and their willingness to bring that history into a future mode. It's another challenge, obviously. We're losing a lot of downtown workers and an important part of our community. But I do think this is another challenge that we'll be able to make it into an asset, she continued. I don't know what that looks like right now, but I have a lot of confidence in that. State Farm officials says Thursday the company has not decided what to do with the building other than pull out the current 150 employees at the end of January and finish maintenance work expected to take another few months. Since 2015, the company spent $1.6 million on improvements to the company's original corporate headquarters, including asbestos abatement and new fire sprinklers and alarms. Schmidt said she's not familiar with the interior of the building other than the ground floor and penthouse, but she looks forward to learning more soon. We can count on them to be good neighbors when they decide, and said Schmidt of State Farm. Maybe that's the downtown hotel. I've heard people suggest it be a vertical mall. With some creativity, anything's possible. Kyle Hamm, CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council, said it's too early to tell what the building could become, but he's in contact with State Farm about it. We'll work closely with State Farm to make sure we can use that property in the most efficient way for the community, and we look forward to doing that, he said. We're at the very infancy stages of what it means, but it's right there in downtown, and it is historic. It's a valuable piece of property, so we look forward to working with State Farm to see what that might mean. Hamm said he also looks forward to speaking with the city about the site. The city of Bloomington and their council have been very focused on downtown development, and they're very attuned to seeing progress and growing that part of the community, said Hamm. I see any opportunity for space to be used as an opportunity. I don't see that as a challenge. Other downtown buildings are vacant or will be vacated soon, include the Commerce Bank building at 120 North Center Street, the Front and Center building at 102 North Center Street, and the Pantograph building at 301 West Washington Street. Continuing on with other local news, our next story is entitled Payments to Normal West Football Coaches Violated IHSA Bylaws. Some McLean County Unit 5 football fans claim the high school coaches were recently forced to step down by the district over false accusations of improper use of booster club funds, though the coaches say they resigned for personal reasons. However, stipends to assistant coaches from the booster club, which were at the heart of the allegation, did violate bylaws, according to officials at Illinois High School Association and Unit 5. Darren Hess, head football coach at Normal Community West High School, resigned in December, 2 days after Normal Community High School football coach Wes Temples stepped down. Both coaches, who retained their teaching jobs, cited similar reasons for leaving: needing more time for family, attending graduate school, or working in school administration. Jeff Lord, treasurer of the Normal West Gridiron Football Booster Club, told the school board Wednesday that a month before Hess's resignation, Lord received an email from district officials asking if any booster club money had been used to pay assistant coaches on the team. Lord confirmed there were minuscule payments to assistant coaches from the booster club through the school, but there was nothing done under the table. "This isn't new. We've done it for years. It's 2,000 or 3,000 split between 6 or 8 coaches," said Lord on Wednesday. Lord claims the payments were allowed by the district, but he believes the action was used as an excuse to force Hess to resign. At Wednesday night's board meeting, several parents claimed the issue was brought to the board's attention by a small group of parents who were unhappy with Hess. "If there is any remuneration to the coaches, it has to be approved by the Board of Education," said Craig Anderson, executive director of IHSA. Unit 5 attorney Kurt Richardson said not all of those payments were approved by the board. "That's a violation of our own board policy, which prohibits payments of coaches through activity funds. This payment strategy never made it up to the district office. Nobody at the district office was aware they had arranged this practice at Normal West," said Richardson. Anderson said IHSA is aware of the situation, but is not presently investigating the issue, because Unit 5 is working through this locally. Athletic directors at University High School, Bloomington High School, and Central Catholic High School said funds from athletic boosters are not used to pay assistant coaches. Richardson said the district is taking action to make sure this stipend payment doesn't happen again. "This was brought to light through an internal audit through our finance department," he said. When asked if the violation led to Hess's termination, Richardson said, "That is a personal matter. I can say Mr. Hess submitted his own resignation." In 2014, Hess was given the option by Unit 5 officials to resign or be fired due to a violation of IHSA bylaws. The option was given to Hess after his IHSA suspension for the remainder of the 2014 season expired. 5 days later, he was asked to return to West as football coach, which he accepted. Hess did not reply to requests for comment Thursday. He remains a social studies teacher at Normal West. Temples said his decision to resign was unrelated to anything happening at Normal West. When he resigned, Temples cited a desire to pursue a master's degree and spend more time with his wife, Shay, and their 4 children. He said getting into administration, possibly as an athletic director, is a very, very big aspiration for me. "People are wanting to lump us and CHS into other things, and that's just not accurate," Temples said. "I can honestly say, with everything I am and who I am, that the reason I resigned is exactly what I told you in December. I hear rumors and the timing of some things probably don't look real good, but I can promise you nothing different has occurred here. Deep down, I've known since the summer I would resign. In talking with my family after the season, it's what's right." Temples had an 83-25 record in 10 seasons. He called his time as coach a phenomenal experience from day one until I resigned. He remains at NCHS as a physical education and driver's education teacher. Hess had a 96-56 record in his 15-year tenure. The Wildcats made the playoffs 12 times and won 2 Big 12 conference championships. West shared the title in 2004 and won it outright in 2011. And we have more news about local high schools with our next article entitled "Mattoon High Shooting Suspect May Be Moved." The defense attorney of the teenager accused of the September 20th Mattoon High School shooting is expected to make a motion to place the boy in a different facility. At a Coles County court hearing Thursday, the boy's attorney, Ed Pirano of Champaign, indicated he will file a motion to find a placement for the boy other than in the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice detention facility. Pirano also signaled that the psychiatrist, Lawrence Jekyll, who is tasked with completing a mental health evaluation for the boy, would be willing to offer testimony that would pertain to the motion. Previously, Jekyll was granted records for a mental health evaluation of the boy. As previously reported, the evaluation will address the possibility of insanity at the time of the incident, whether the boy is a risk to himself or others, and if he's able to understand and help with his case. Coles County State's Attorney Brian Bauer said a different facility would provide different treatment options for the youth. A motion has not been filed, so a specific request of a facility was not discussed at the hearing that was continued to February 2nd. Bauer and Pirano agreed to this court date during the hearing before Circuit Judge Matt Sullivan. The teen was a 14-year-old freshman at the time of the shooting in the school's cafeteria. Another boy who reportedly was not the actual target was shot during the incident before the shooter was subdued, according to authorities' accounts. The boy was hit in the upper chest, but accounts indicate he is recovering from his wounds. In juvenile court, the teen is charged with aggravated battery with a firearm. It's a felony offense that could lead to him being held in the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice until the age of 21. According to information presented during a previous hearing from authorities, the teen allegedly started to aim the gun at a girl, but MHS teacher Angie McQueen grabbed him by the arm, and the shot hit the other student instead. More shots were fired into the cafeteria ceiling before McQueen and Mattoon Police School Resource Officer Casey Alexander subdued the boy, according to the accounts. Some sources have indicated that bullying might have been the motivation for the shooting, but officials involved in the investigation have not released information regarding a possible motive. Authorities have not said how the boy was able to bring the gun inside the school. And continuing on with our next story, which is entitled "Local Animal Cruelty Cases Under Review by Authorities." McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers said he will review a veterinary report before making a decision on filing additional charges against a woman accused of animal cruelty. Susan Green, 61, of Normal, was originally charged with a misdemeanor count of animal cruelty after authorities said she left her dog Carla outside during a recent cold snap. Police found the dog last week under a tree, barely moving, with an icy nose and its ears and tail frozen. The dog was taken to a veterinary clinic, but did not survive, police said. Green was released on a personal recognizance bond for the Class A charge, but could face additional charges because the dog died after she was arrested. She's due in court for a status hearing on February 26th. Another case of alleged animal cruelty is under investigation in Macon County. A 23-year-old Decatur man is in custody, accused of allowing a pet dog to freeze to death and then trying to cover it up. Macon County Animal Control officers were called Tuesday afternoon to a backyard where they said they found a female pit bull that had frozen to death. Police said they determined the dog had died 2 weeks earlier and that the owner put the dead dog in a doghouse at his home, then dragged it into the backyard of another residence. The family called authorities after finding the dog, police said. In other local criminal justice news, our next article is entitled "Local Man Convicted of Abusing Teenager." A Bloomington man was convicted Thursday of sexually abusing a teenage girl during the time the two were together over 3 months at his home. The guilty verdict on three counts and an acquittal of a fourth charge of aggravated criminal sexual assault was returned by Judge Scott Drzewski after a four-day bench trial and the 50-year-old defendant. In his ruling, the judge singled out DNA test results as the primary reason for the verdict. "It's a scientific evidence, the DNA, that rules the day," said Drzewski in the ruling delivered late Thursday. Results from DNA tests on a condom found in Wichman's bathroom supported the state's contention that the suspect and the girl engaged in sexual activity, said Drzewski. The judge noted that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case that could be interpreted in different ways. The statements from the alleged victim contained inconsistencies, some of them on major points, related to when and how the purported sexual activity took place, said the judge. Other testimony, including the information provided by the teen's brother, was not believable, he said. The relationship between Wichman and the minor was not easily defined. The judge opined, based on the suspect's actions, such as providing food and clothing to the child, actions that were in her best interests, and his contrasting inappropriate contact, such as buying her jewelry and making romantic overtures and text messages. In his closing arguments Thursday, Assistant State's Attorney Jacob Harlow said the teenage girl liked being with him because they had this understanding that she got to do what she wanted. The DNA evidence was a key element of the state's case, said Harlow. Defense lawyer Jennifer Patton argued the girl's testimony as to when the sex may have occurred was inconsistent. The teen's allegations that Wichman cut himself when she rebuffed his sexual advances were not proved, said Patton. Just because it's weird and creepy doesn't mean it's criminal, Patton said of the pairing of the adult man and troubled teenage girl. The state played an hour-long interview of Wichman by Bloomington Detective John Heinlein. The suspect denied having sex with the girl during the weeks he claims he was trying to help her and her mother. In the interview, the detective described the girl as the perfect storm, an abused and abandoned creature, searching for love from the family friend she considered her world, her savior. For the girl's mother, Wichman was a godsend, said Harlow, because the suspect took over most of the day-to-day care of the girl, including buying her clothes and smoothing her rocky relationship with her mother. State's attorney Jason Chambers credited the Children's Advocacy Center staff and Heinlein with helping the victim's voice be heard. Trials can traumatize a survivor all over again, and they were there to support her, along with Jake Harlow, said Chambers. A March 9th sentencing hearing is scheduled for Wichman. And now we have a short article entitled, Beard Seeks Chairmanship. A former precinct committeeman who has served as vice chair of the McLean County Republican Party has announced this week she will seek the county chair post being vacated by Chuck Erickson. Connie Beard of Bloomington said she plans to build on the work of Erickson, who announced Tuesday that he would not seek re-election. The county chair will be elected to a two-year term by precinct committeemen at a party convention in April, following the March primary. Beard is not currently a precinct committeeman, but she is on the March ballot. The county chair and executive board are responsible for event planning, fundraising, and community outreach. Beard said she also sees serving precinct committeemen as a vital part of being county chair. In addition to prior service as a precinct committeeman and vice chair, Beard has worked on several campaigns, including as county coordinator for Erica Harold's 2013 race for Congress. She and her husband, David Beard, have lived in Bloomington since 1988 and are active members of Vail Church. She works as a realtor at Denbeston Real Estate in Bloomington. Noting that much attention has been focused on national and state candidates, Beard would like the county Republican Party, quote, to have more impact on municipal and local government. Beard said her goals as the party's county chair would be to support and grow our base, develop more leadership at the precinct level, find more people to serve as volunteers in Republican Party, and do a better job of sharing Republican principles with the community at large. She said Republican principles include having small government with less demand for taxes, promoting more individual responsibility and accountability, and encouraging active involvement by voters. She intends to promote those principles through public forums and multimedia sources. And our next article is entitled, Radon Program Transferred to Community Action. A program to reduce radon health risks in McLean County has been transferred from the Ecology Action Center to Mid-Central Community Action in a move that both agencies believe will benefit homeowners. McLean County's Radon Awareness Program is being administered, effective Thursday, by MCCA. EAC had the program for about 7 years after taking it over from Illinois State University. We're very excited that MCCA is happy to take this on and will continue this excellent program, which dovetails well with their existing programs, EAC's Executive Director Michael Brown told the Pantograph. Increasing the community's awareness of this significant health risk is in line with MCCA's mission to educate, equip, and empower people to achieve healthy relationships, Finances, Homes, and Neighborhoods, MCCA Executive Director Deborah White said in a prepared statement. Radon is an odorless, colorless, tasteless radioactive gas produced by the decay of naturally occurring uranium in the soil. Radon moves through the soil and enters homes through gaps in the foundation. Radon becomes a problem when it accumulates at high levels. When it's inhaled, it enters the lungs. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the country. EPA estimates that 1 in 15 homes has elevated radon levels. The only way to detect radon is through testing. Radon test kits are available at many hardware stores, and MCCA and EAC sell them for $10 at their offices and at radonmclean.org, said Brown and Matt Dratt, MCCA Director of Resource Development and Community Engagement. Every home needs to be tested for radon, Brown said. When high radon levels are detected, homeowners are encouraged to hire an Illinois Emergency Management Agency licensed mitigation professional to install a radon mitigation system, Brown said. For the program, last year, EAC received a $12,000 Environmental Protection Agency grant that passed through the Illinois Emergency Management Agency, Brown said. But changes in the grant administration made it difficult for EAC to continue the program, Brown said. Transferring it to MCCA makes sense because of its experience with federal grants, Brown said. MCCA's staff person responsible for its green initiative will administer the radon program, Dratt said. We're going to continue all the great work that the EAC and Radon Task Force have been doing, including the test kits and awareness programs, Dratt said. MCCA will integrate radon awareness information into its work with low-income families and its programs at Jefferson Street Community House. And now we have a short story out of Chicago entitled Chicago Police May Get Anti-Texting Technology. Chicago may become the first city in the U.S. to arm its police officers with devices that will tell them immediately if motorists were texting when they got into a traffic accident. After hearing from a father whose son was killed in a traffic accident in which the driver was texting, as well as a company that developed a prototype of the so-called textilizer, the City Council's Public Safety Committee voted Thursday to request that the police department study the handheld device. The vote sends the issue to the full council, which is all but certain to approve the resolution next week. A number of states are considering equipping law enforcement officials with the devices, including New York, New Jersey, and Tennessee. But one of the co-sponsors of the resolution, Alderman Edward Burke, said Chicago would be the first U.S. city to do so. The problem of distracted driving is only getting worse, said Burke, who pointed to statistics that show the number of people killed in traffic accidents jumps to 14% between 2014 and 2016 as evidence of the toll distracted driving is taking. This is a public health crisis. The vote was taken after Ben Lieberman, who became the face of the push for the devices after his 19-year-old son was killed in 2011, spoke of his son's death and his own discovery that not only is texting while driving rampant, it is all but impossible to investigate, and what laws there are prohibiting distracted driving are rarely enforced. You don't need me to tell you that, he said. You just need to look out your window. And we'll wrap up the first half of the Pantograph News today with today's Flick Fact. So the question, much of the road salt covering streets and roads all over Illinois after a snowstorm has a direct tie to Bloomington Normal. Do you know what it is? Well, if you don't, I'll tell you the answer. Carrie Scharf Trucking, a company founded in 1981 by Joe Scharf of Bloomington, has become one of the leading companies for transporting salt from river barges to cities across Illinois. The company handles salt for North American Salt and Morton Salt, among others. That's it for the first half of the Pantograph News today. This is from the edition dated Friday, January 12th. My name is Matt Woodbury. Please stick around with us and we'll have more for the Pantograph later. And thank you for listening.